Number four. What did you do, both personally and as a flight, in the several weeks at Netheravon?
Well, we were up at 6 o'clock, Ravalli. We were out on the square and got bashed about for an hour. Then we had breakfast and we had working parade at 8 o'clock. We went down and we got the aircraft out and saw that everything was ready for flight, and then just waited until one of the pilots wanted the aircraft. Then we start up and let him go. When he returned, we waited for him to return. When he returned, then we filled up the tanks again and checked the oil and had a general check over, see the engine was okay, and left at that. Then the technical, or the disciplinarian NCO crept into it. And they went around, if they saw us, we weren't doing anything, they'd make us pick up some papers and matchstick, which they'd already dropped, just to make work for us until lunchtime. Then we went back and had lunch, but marched back with the camp, which is about a quarter of a mile away at the other end of the camp from the hangars. And after that, then we were down to the hangars again and took out any aircraft that the pilots wanted and sent them off and checked everything, went over the usual routine.
From what you say, it sounds as if you spent quite a lot of time hanging around at the beck and call of the pilots, and that while they were up in the air, you probably didn't have too much to do.
Well, we had nothing to do while they were in the air, except every Saturday morning all the aircraft had to be pushed out on the tarmac, and we had to scrub the floor. There were wooden floors in the hangar there in that particular place. We had to scrub these white with a lot of caustic soda stuff. We got them that just like a yacht's deck. We had to keep them that way. But there was one thing in Netheravon in Seafly which I'm very sorry I never copied out. It was standing orders for flying, which had been posted up there about 1912 or 13, I'm not quite sure which. It was stuck on one of the walls. In this it stated that under no circumstances was an aircraft to leave the ground without previously ringing up Lark Hill, the Met Office, and if the wind was exceeded 10 miles an hour, the aircraft wasn't to leave the ground.
But it would be exceeding 10 miles an hour most of the time, I would think.
Well, no, but that was out of date in about 6 or 12 months, because the aircraft then and the pilots become so much more experienced that they could cope with much stronger winds.
Could you tell me in a little more detail about your own work as an engine mechanic?
Well, you were absolutely responsible for the engine, and when you decided that it wasn't running correctly, you had to take it out, overhaul it, and put another one in, because we always had a second engine already overhauled, lying in the back of the hangar, ready for such an emergency. Well, at one particular time, we had aircraft came down two or three times before we rumbled what was wrong. When we checked up, we found that there were some earwigs in the carburetor, and we couldn't understand how these came in. But Netheravon and that district was noted for its earwigs. There were hundreds of them going about, until somebody happened to look up on this shelf where we kept the funnels to we used for putting the petrol in. I used to pour it out of cans. Well, this funnel had a gauze in it, and it also had a double layer of chamois leather fastened round it, so the petrol went through the double chamois leather first and then through the gauze. And one day a chap was glancing up at this shelf, and he saw an earwig walk up the side of the funnel, and when he got on top, he fell in. so that he was actually, he was on the inside of the funnel, resting on the gauze. Well, when we, anybody filled the petrol down, turn it up to fill the petrol, we simply washed these into the petrol tank, but we couldn't see them. And we saw, when we found out what was wrong then, we were able to correct it, and that accounted for the earwigs getting in the petrol tank and in the carburetor.
Were there any other problems which used to occur with the engines at this time? Problems perhaps not due to such exotic things as earwigs?
Yes, well, no, there was a trouble with the rotary engines. The rotary engine used pure castor oil, and it used the pure castor oil because the petrol and the oil were mixed in the crankcase and then passed into the cylinders. And so that she drew in a certain amount of castor oil each time she drew in the gas. Well, this castor oil, when in frosty weather, it used to freeze into hard lumps. And you couldn't break it with a sledgehammer when you hit it. You just put a piece on the ground and hit it with a sledgehammer, the hammer simply bounced off it. So we had a bit of trouble until we discovered that we could get rid of that. So in the very cold weather, we used to drain the oil tanks at night and then heat it up in the morning over a bit of petrol rag or something like that, so as to warm it and then put it in. Otherwise, we'd have had more of this trouble. But as I say, we only found these things out through trial and error and using common sense.
Any other problems which occurred of this kind?
No, nothing of more of that kind.
Were there any incidents at Netheravon which you would like to tell me about?
Well, in November 14, a detachment of us was picked out, and that happened to be my flight, C flight, to go over to Winchester and remain there for a fortnight to let the infantry and the horses, there were thousands of horses belonged to the army there, get used to aircraft flying over them. And we went over there, and the officer in charge had gone over 3 or 4 days previously and picked out some billet for us. Well, I was detailed to drive the Crossley tender over at the time, and he had found a field on the Petersfield Road, but it happened to be in a bit of a dip. It seemed all right. So we went over there and landed. The aircraft came over, the four aircraft of the flight. And we got there on the, I think it was about on the Friday. And on the Sunday afternoon, Major Longcroft, he was in charge at the time, just before he left, came over in his Miranda to see how things were going, and he landed there. Well, after he'd satisfied himself everything was going well, he took off, and just as he got about 50 feet up, he struck an air pocket, which of course was most dangerous in those days for those particular aircraft. And his aircraft simply dropped dead to about 6 feet from the ground before the engine was racing away hard, before the engine picked up and took it up again. And it was only his great experience as a pilot which saved his life. Well, he went off back to Netheravon. Well, when we were later on, about when it got dark, we packed up and we went back to our billets. And I happened to mention this thing to the gentleman with whom we were billeted. And he said, oh, he said, that's a dangerous place, he said to me. Why don't you use the field that Hamill gave his exhibition on 18 months ago? So I said, Hamill, I said, where's that? So he described it to me. Well, next morning, when I went in, As a matter of fact, the officer that was in charge of us then was a younger brother of Gilbert de Laferte, the afterwards Air Marshal or Air Vice Marshal. And he said, "Do you think you could find it?" So I said, "Yes." So we went up and we found this field, and it was a wonderful landing ground. Beautiful big field, perfectly level in every respect, and no hazards, no big trees around or anything. So he saw the farmer, and that afternoon we packed up everything and went straight up there. And that afterwards was worthy down, and that afterwards became a very renowned airdrome, known all throughout the Air Force. As I previously said, we were over there with the sole intention of letting horses and infantry know what it was like to have aircraft going over their heads. Well, there was a place called Mourne Hill, just outside Winchester. There was a big flat open space, well high up, and there were thousands of horses here, all tethered out in the open. And we'd had a very wet spell before that, with the result that they were up to their knees in mud, and the men looking after them, they were just as bad. The horses dying every night. Well, it looked a terrible sight from the air to see all these horses trying to break away from their tethers with the and clumping around in the mud while we went overhead, but we just had to, nothing else to do. We had to let go over. And it was the same way with the infantry. We found that when the infantry were marching and we went over them, every one of them looked up, and with their white faces, they were a perfect target, because you see all these white faces going up, and of course they were, when they were looking up, they couldn't march properly. And we wanted to get them used to this. This was our instruction to keep going. So after about, we were there a fortnight, and then we returned to Netherhaven.
Could you describe the tests that you actually carried out?
Well, we first of all started flying over them at about, 2,000 feet. And then we, after two or three times at that, then we come down to about 1,500.
Can you remember what the reaction was at that first height?
The first height, the horses were very restless, and as I say, the infantry were continually looking up, which just didn't want them to do, because their faces gave the position away too clearly. Well, the infantry, of course, soon said, well, when they saw one of us coming over, they had their own way of expressing their thoughts about us.
So then you tried the same thing at a lower height?
Then we gradually came down until we could go over those horses at about 500 feet, and not one of them took any notice of us.
When you first started flying these at these very low heights, did you get any sort of stampedes or anything like that?
We worked it gradually, you see. I mean, we'd go over in the morning and go over, say, about 1,500 feet, or and go several times over them, until they realised that we weren't going any nearer and there was no danger. Then we gradually worked it down until finally we could get down to about 500 feet and the horses just ignored us.
Bayless.
I remember one time at Netherhaven in 14 when a Canadian officer came over to us flying some type of RE machine. And supposed to be designed by the engineers or something like that. RE it was anyway. And we fixed up a dummy bomb weighing 500 pounds because this aircraft was supposed to be able to lift anything. And he was going to take it up to 500 feet. Well, he was going to take it up, see how far he could get it up in the air with the object of as an experiment. Well, we filled them up with fuel and we put this concrete thing on and on the bottom and under the fuselage and a release on it. And he went up. Well, he was flying round for about 3 hours and the highest he got was 500 feet. The thing just wouldn't lift it any higher. And when we watched him and he released it, well, as soon as it left the machine, the aircraft went up just like a balloon for a while. But eventually he landed, and we forgot all about 500-pound bombs at that time.
Because by the standards of the time, 500 pounds for a bomb would be an enormous weight.
It was.
You but were course, what? You were it was playing on, with 10-pounders and things like that at this time.
20-pounders were our big ones, but then somebody in the designing staff had got it into their head, and with their calculations, this particular aircraft should have lifted 500 pounds.
But it wasn't to be.
It wasn't to be. Previous to the war, there were a number of aircraft going around the country giving exhibitions and joyrides for passengers at 10 shillings a time. Well, one of these, by the name of Busteed, he used to work with Pigo down at Bournemouth. He was the second pilot, Busteed was. And as he'd had his wings, he was given the opportunity of seeing what he could do with an aircraft at Netheravon with the view to becoming a pilot.